My name is Tom Chick. You are listening to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast. For this week, we will be discussing Robin Hood. Directed by Ridley Scott. I am joined by Christian Makrowski. Did I get that right? I think I got close that time.
You are so bold with that. It's actually pronounced Took.
Okay. We also have with us this week Kelly Wand, who... Kelly Wand, do you have a tagline for this week's podcast?
Agnes, my blue and yellow... You don't remember that line? All right, this one. All right, forget that. New catchphrase. Godfrey and his marauders are French!
Good. That's a good tagline. Now, for folks who maybe haven't seen... If you haven't seen it, we're going to spoil it for you, just so you know. So if you care about seeing Robin Hood, you should bail. If you don't care about seeing Robin Hood, stick around. If you've seen it, stick around. And Kelly Wand, why don't you spoil it for everyone and tell us what happens in this movie?
All right. So I got into the theater, and there was this banana peel on the seat beside me in that little cup holder. So I told the usher, and he said he'd get it after the movie because the owner might come back. But then... sometime between the Killers trailer and the Night Day trailer, the smell started getting to me. So I dropped it on the floor, and then Robin Hood came on. And then after it was over, I got up to leave, and then I tripped on it, and I fell, and I cracked my skull on the floor, and I died.
All right, wow. Okay. that's a good
kind
summary. Sounds like quite... How did your audience react to all of that?
That was the only time they applauded during Robin Hood.
Okay.
But it was the way I died. I don't think they were rooting against me.
Right.
They were rooting for the peel.
You're a lovable fan.
They looked stupefied. I saw with a bunch of, like, fun-loving teenagers, like the way I saw Indiana Jones 4, and everyone emerged from the same way. I wanted to clap, but there wasn't a moment. Mm-hmm. They looked so frustrated. Mm-hmm.
You saw Robin Hood out of state. You saw Robin Hood with real Americans. How did they react to the movie?
I had the most amazing, loud, demonstrative woman behind me. And she said some awesome, awesome things during it. First of all, we couldn't get into my theater right away because somebody in the show before us had broken a bottle of vodka on the floor.
Yeah. Was this the ArcLight in Virginia? Because it's sort of out of picture. Except I can't picture them actually having bottles.
Oh, no, it was the York River Crossing in Gloucester, Virginia. It was great.
Oh, near Barnham?
There's a couple of moments where she said some choice words that I wrote down that really made the movie sing.
Now, before we get into those moments, let's just go around the room. Show of hands, who liked Robin Hood? Okay, show of hands now.
I like Robin Hood, the idea of Robin Hood.
All right, the Brian Helgeland written, Ridley Scott directed movie.
Damn you, Helgeland. Twice in a year.
He's got a third chance, too, with Salt. We have Green Zone, Robin Hood, and Salt are all Brian Helgeland scripts. And I'm getting
Salt?
Salt is this Angelina Jolie spy movie or something. I know.
Yeah.
But it's directed by...
Night and Day.
Killers? Oh, right. But on the subject of Brian Helgeland scripts, Salt is directed by Philip Noyce, which I find reason to be somewhat excited about. But it's a Brian Helgeland script, which puts me right back at neutral ground there. So I just thought the script for this was just terrible, just awful. I had many other problems with it, but I'm no longer a Brian Helgeland fan. He got a lot of goodwill for Payback. Never saw Knight's Tale, but I really liked his version of Payback before Mel Gibson took over. You can rent that these days. It's very cool. But I'm not a Brian Helgeland fan anymore. It's official. I'm ripping up my fan card.
Yeah, if you're going to get Payback, you have to get the Payback straight up director's cut. You I think that's the one you have to see, right?
Right. Yep. Absolutely. And that was I think Brian Helgeland before he sucked.
That's the one without Kris Kristofferson.
Exactly. Where the villain is a chick. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. How can you take Sally Kellerman's voice?
And he dies at the end. Spoiler alert.
And sub in Kris Kristofferson.
Or does he?
Yeah. Exactly. Or does he? Yeah. I'm going with that. So anyway, I did not care for Robin Hood. Dingus, your turn. What did you think?
I really liked it.
Wow, that was so forced. Did that cause pain when you said that?
It did. I hope I can get on the plane in the morning.
I thought Dingus was an actor. I'm not impressed. He's got the looks of an actor, but not the execution there.
And
I have one of the nuggets that the woman said with the vodka behind you.
All right, yeah, so I just wanted to make sure that we weren't going to offend, that nobody here was like a huge fan of Robin Hood, so that we should tread lightly and not offend
them. Whoa.
Just wanted to be sure.
No, I'm a huge fan of Robin Hood.
But of the Ridley Scott, and I'm not sure there was any sign of him. I'll be curious what you think in this movie we just saw.
Right. This movie wasn't about Robin Hood, so I can feel comfortable saying that I really liked Robin Hood.
But the thing, this was what was funny about this movie, and I did not realize this until it was over, that this was a revisionist history origins story.
Yeah.
The fact
about
that
the Plantagenets and how democracy came through the Magna Carta.
The fact that the final title card reads, "And now the legend begins."
Yeah.
Almost like it needed a question mark or something.
Then the credits start. Credits are the legend.
Oh, my God. I did not see credits. I know for the credits they did that cool, like, you know, Scott Free Production Company has that cool, like, almost like watercolory shifting logo thing of the man running through the door. So I noticed they were doing the credits in that, and I was like, oh, that looks interesting, but I'm sick of being in this theater. I'm leaving. So
the first time my audience turned on the movie was when the second title card came up, like 5 minutes into the movie, like after this sort of baffling sequence with Marion and the farmers.
Right.
And then it goes, "Meanwhile, 30 years later, France."
The audience didn't like that.
No.
Right. Dingus, what did your – tell us something that this woman really enjoyed with whom you saw Robin Hood.
I don't think she enjoyed it, but she had a lot of derisive remarks that were fun.
Oh, I wished I'd been there. That sounds good.
Or direct to the screen remarks. Like, for instance, she got excited when Robin Longstride punched Little John in the face when they were playing their Let's Hide the Pea game before they screwed up the final, you know, the joke by not showing us the shot.
Right.
Not
I didn't get that.
But when he punched him and then you punch him back and he cracks his neck, she goes, "Oh, hell yeah." She thought, like, now the movie's going to take off. Now it's
take that
go.
Person who didn't get ripped off by Robin Hood.
That scene right there was for me an early instance of, good Lord, this is going to be a long haul. That whole pea scene segueing into the king in disguise among his men, which is, you know, right out of Henry V or whatever. Yeah. And then how that goes into the speech about the massacre at Acre, and then how he gets put in the stockades and he's pouting and deciding he's going to become a deserter. I was like, oh, my God, really? This is how this is going to progress? I totally lost all faith in anything interesting or fun happening in the movie. Beginning with that, from that arc, from finding out Robin Hood was a New York, like, street shyster, to that he's going to desert because he's pouting for being put in the stockades because he is indeed naive enough to tell the king the truth, which you don't do that, especially if it's a putz like Danny Houston. If that's your Richard the Lionhearted, he doesn't really want to know what you thought about the massacre at Acre. Keep your mouth shut, you dork.
If when someone asks if you're a god, you say yes. Do you guys care about old Robin Hood at all? Like, stuff that wasn't in this movie that is kind of iconic?
Well,
Robin Hood.
I was hoping you guys...
Stay spraying as a trap.
I kind of want you guys to take me to task for this, because my feeling generally, as I've said before, is I don't mind if source material is deviated from. I like seeing different people's interpretations of stories. So I was trying to keep that in mind while watching this, that these were familiar names, these were characters that we've seen in other stories, and this is somebody else's interpretation. But I really do believe that this tests the limits of my theory in that it completely misses the point in so many instances of what makes the source material great. I mean, it's not just an interpretation. It's a fundamental misreading, I think, of the source material, of what makes Robin Hood cool. There was no sign of that in here. I got the sense that this could have just been any story about some guy in 13th century England. And it happened to have the name Robin Hood, just seemed random. And, you know, it was just names from the Robin Hood stories and nothing else. That was the sense I got. So I felt they didn't even interpret the source material. They just borrowed names and put it on a different story about basically how some dude's father wrote the Magna Carta. You know, the fact that that was the reveal was so ridiculous to me.
He also put it in some words on a hilt, and then he put them on stone, under the stone, with handprints. But is it one of the things that makes Robin Hood cool that he gets this hot rich girl, Maid Marian, and now he's just in this, he gets like a widow farmer who's sort of empowered, but then he has to rescue her at the end anyway.
Dingus, why don't you feel that one? I got something to say, but Dingus, you go first.
I have no idea, and I couldn't care less.
Well,
it's, and I'm not trying to Bigfoot you or anything, Kelly. It's just that. I'm all for, or I didn't realize I was going in to see an origin tale. And I even through all of those pages of text we had to read, I really quite still get that's what we were in for. And then very late in the film, I started to feel like if this is the tale, then why bother with this? This is not an interesting tale as you're telling it. I just want to get to the antics. You know, when the A-Team comes out, I don't want to see all the stuff that they talk about in the intro to the A-Team about how they were framed. I just want to see their antics. You know, I just want to see Robin Hood antics. And unless you're going to give me something that's really interesting about how these guys came to be and how they're distinct and who the Merry Men are and how they're distinct, and instead they're just going to be this sort of generic band of, they're not even thieves. I don't know what they are. They are so poorly fleshed out, and Merry is so poorly done that I just didn't care.
My issue with Kate Blanchett's Marion, for one, was that there was no chemistry. By the way, my main problem with this movie was Brian Helgeland's script. My second main problem, and it's close to tying with the problem I had with Helgeland's script, is Russell Crowe, who I thought was just awful and dull and brooding. And this is an example of when Russell Crowe just does nothing for me. I thought he was awful in this, and he had no chemistry with Kate Blanchett. So Kate Blanchett's character, her maid Marion, to me was this just stupid male fantasy of a woman who can whistle for the dogs, who can stab a rapist in the back of the neck, who can sass priests and sheriffs, she can plow fields, she can shoot arrows, she can fight with a sword, and she can lead a charge of basically Ewok kids in the battle at the end. I mean, she was just this stupid place. I mean, it was just a male fantasy of, awesome, hey, here's the all-around chick in the 13th century. I just thought it was so stupid. So that was my
doing. I just never knew what the hell she was doing.
Yeah.
Not just what was she doing in this film, it's just what was she doing? It just felt like she just couldn't be bothered to come up with a real characterization, so she would just do goofy curtsies.
It's not on the page. You can't blame her for Helgeland.
There's one instance where, so in this whole convoluted, misbegotten story about this guy who inherits somebody else's identity, you know, he comes to her to tell her basically that her husband is dead. And he doesn't realize necessarily that that's what he's saying at this point. When he brings this news, he's wanting to be brought to Max von Sydow. And Ridley Scott does a long shot of her walking forward with her back to him after hearing this news and being very impassive. And I remember when he delivers it, I wasn't really clear necessarily on what was going on. The whole movie is so murky with all the machinations and relationships. I was thinking, wait, didn't he just tell her husband is dead? And she doesn't seem to react. But then she turns and she has her back to him, and she's leading him into the household, and she sort of falters. Her step falters, and it's a little character thing where it's like, oh, okay, she really is affected. She's just being stoic. But then we later find out we find out that she only knew the guy for a week, and she doesn't really, it doesn't really have any impact on her whatsoever. So I was wondering, what is that little falter? What did that mean? You know, that was, I thought, a Cate Blanchett character choice, and they edited in that scene and made it very clear, but it just didn't go anywhere. What were they doing with that? Why was that there?
She also buries her dad, and then, like, seconds later is kissing Russell Crowe with, like, a smile for the first time. Like, this is such an awesome day, dude. I love you.
Hey, I gotta jump off for a second. I'll be right back, guys.
All right.
Mm. Getting back to your pushing the limits of changing the source material.
Right.
There's a certain point at which it's something. It's not that it's wrong. It's that I'm not interested. Like, yes. If they want to cast Chris O'Donnell as Han Solo, that's fine. I just won't see it. I'm not going to be there, and I don't care.
I must say, Kelly Wand, hold on. That I would not dream of missing that. Chris O'Donnell's Han Solo. That right there is just so misbegotten. I am fascinated. I get what you're saying. Absolutely. Yeah.
But everything that Robin Hood stands for, this braggadocio, and this guy would like walk into the king's court with the deer on his shoulders and just throw it there. I kept waiting for that scene. And you go, oh, it's going to be at the end when they're enemies, and then we get jacked out of that too.
There were very brief touches of that when they first rob the grain and he poses a riddle to them. I was like, oh, I think he's going to do a little riddle and then there might be swashbuckling. But there wasn't. There was nothing, you know. And the riddle, by the way, wasn't even a riddle. I thought there was going to be some banter there. It was basically just a taunt. That was no riddle. That was stupid. But
the riddle?
The riddle was, what has 18 legs and isn't going anywhere?
Oh.
The answer being, you guys, you know.
Knock, knock, who's there? Fuck you.
Knock, knock, who's there? I shoot an arrow at you, you know. That's a stupid joke. Robin,
were there any good jokes? I thought the
so
audience
my audience loved Max von Sydow telling Russell Crowe that he stank. Not my audience, but an older gentleman sitting nearby me. He laughed uproariously at that, and he loved the joke about the fact that knight and knight with a K are homonyms, where Cate Blanchett has her little sexual confusion, and woo, it was so titillating. So he loved that. So there were those two jokes in there, yeah. Yeah.
So there was a joke about the size of little John's penis. That was funny.
What was this?
That was all right.
What was that joke?
It was little John, what are you trying to imply?
There's one of the 15 party scenes, because there was 20% more party scenes than battle scenes in this movie. And so
Fire Tuck was good.
Will Scarlet or somebody, one of the miscellaneous dopes, asks him if, you know, where he got the name Little John. He says, I'm proportionate.
Oh, didn't even hear that.
Runs after.
Hey, what did the woman? Give us another woman behind you nugget.
So, Robin Long's tried, and his men are pretending to be Loxley and other knights because knights are just real people underneath the skin. Da da da, revisionism. And they walk up to the king and give him the crown, as if he's uncovering a dish. And the king goes, you deserve a reward. And he takes his ring off his finger and hands it over to him. And the woman behind me goes, a ring.
Wait, the woman said that?
That's
yeah.
Awesome.
By the way, I got to spell out on my paper.
By the way, that helmet was the stupidest looking helmet I've ever seen. It looked like a cross between a biking helmet and a salad bowl. I was like, that's the crown? That's what you're going to wear to show your king? That is stupid. That is a terrible crown. Dumb.
So it doesn't matter who you are. You're a knight as long as you stole his clothes.
Well, there's a whole speech there. You know that.
And you can also change your last name. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. This was a movie, Kelly Wand, about identity. What do you think of that?
Like the Joan Cusack movie? It adds up.
Okay, so let's talk about...
How so? Wait, whoa.
What?
Say something good and then leave it hanging, Mr. Sore.
Oh, no, I was being completely facetious. I mean, the thing is, all that identity stuff was stupid and wasted. And an example of Brian Helgeland's terrible script. There's this idea of, you know, he's assuming different identities, which I don't know why they did that or where they were going with that.
All right, that's the point.
That little bit of historical revisionism about how a knight, anybody can be a knight, which, by the way, they introduced that... right after showing this, you know, people bowing to the king, and I was like, oh, okay, you know, this is going to be realistic, and you know, but nothing, you know, all that goes out the window. Yeah, no, this is not a movie about identity. This is a.
It was like in Bad Boys, the first one, when Martin Lawrence pretended to be Will Smith.
That's a much better movie about identity. Well put.
Yeah. And Tia Leone was still hot, pre-Spanglish.
Oh, that's right. That was Tia Leone, yeah. But I want to ask you guys, I'm curious if you have anything for me here. What were, and were there any, missed opportunities? Things that you thought were really close to being cool, but what do you think came close to being a missed opportunity? Is there anything...
Not going R...
I didn't mind that, Kelly Wong.
Having R-rated.
I mean, I did. We noticed that. Like, we've talked about that a lot on this podcast. Like, when something's not R-rated, and
I'm going to say it every time. I'm going to say it every PG-13 movie we see until they start making only R movies.
Okay, you keep
it. One night crusade. I'm Richard the Lionhearted.
You beat that drum. But Dingus, go first. Are there any missed opportunities or scenes that you thought came really close to being good? I've got a couple, but I want to know. Do you got anything for us, Dingus, that you thought came close to being really good?
Well, actually, I have a number of them, because as I went on, I started collecting moments where I started to feel like, okay, we're not going to get any actual robberies in this movie, but and this is going to sound totally cute and cliched, but I kind of constantly started to feel like we were getting robbed of drama. That there was. I know, I apologize.
There was nothing under the hood of this movie.
That they were really close to having like a dramatic moment,
yep.
And they would just rob us of it because their timing sucked every single time.
Give us an example, because I love that.
Well, you know, the very first one is the one I already referenced, when Kevin Durant tells him that Little John tells him that his shell game is a fraud. And you don't even see the reveal.
Yeah.
That was sort of a minor one. But there was a couple of bigger ones. There's this weird moment where Marion, this is late in the film, Marion is locked in a room with a guy who's about to rape her. And she stabs him, and you can't really tell what the hell's going on in the scene. Mm-hmm. There's this save the baby moment where the baby's handed through the wood. They immediately break out.
I know. It's like, why don't you just carry the baby out when you're about to get let loose? That was so stupid. I thought, well, they hand the baby out, so then everybody's going to die, but only the baby's going to... Oh, no, everybody's fine. Okay.
Did the woman behind you go, oh, a baby. Save the pitchfork.
I think the very biggest moment, the very worst moment where Ridley Scott completely misses what he's trying to do. And Ridley Scott was constantly... making other directors look good in this movie.
It was poorly made.
For instance, he made George Lucas look good by poorly doing taxation and politics in a movie.
Anti-armies we don't know anything about, which is another George Lucas signature.
But he made Steven Spielberg look like a champ with his really just awful storming the beaches at Dover scene. And totally missing the entire point of the dramatic tension or what the timing would be for that sort of, if you're going to crib that storming the beaches at Normandy thing, when the transport gangplank goes down, an arrow has to hit somebody in the head right then. Instead, mm-hmm. you just have people flailing around for half an hour in the water, and then eventually somebody on a ship goes, who are those people? And then they flail around in the water for a while, and then the Lost Boys with Gary Shandling masks show up, and there's more flailing about. It was just no timing whatsoever, no sense of timing at all.
Yeah, it really was a horrible example of a battle scene. Like, I think of the finale of Iron Man 2 last week, which we saw, and then the finale of Robin Hood, and what utterly mismanaged large-scale action sequences they both were. It's just terrible. And the funny thing is, you're right about it being obviously inspired by Saving Private Ryan's Normandy Beach scene, down to specific shots, like from underwater with the arrows flying.
Arrows going, yeah.
Yeah, and bodies floating. And I was like, oh my God, this is such a
stupid... missing all the awesome grace notes that made it rad, like a guy looking for his arm.
Yeah. So the one I want to bring up, and then we'll go to you, Kelly Wand, if you have anything. The one I want to bring up that I hoped came really close to being a good scene. And on paper, with two actors who are better than Cate Blanchett and Russell Crowe and have some sense of chemistry, and if the director had been aware of how cool this scene could be, the whole sequence from Robin Hood deciding that he needs help getting his chainmail off, you know, that undressing, I'm reminded of, and I wasn't a huge fan of The Last Samurai, that Edward Zwick movie with Tom Cruise, but there's a scene at the end of that where...
you saw it.
There's a scene at the end of that where a girl has to dress him in the samurai's outfit. And they've both been very sexually repressed. You know, there's a lot of sexual tension in the scene. It doesn't break that tension. They don't start kissing or anything. But it's this very sensual scene of her dressing him in a samurai outfit. So I thought, you know, a really good director, two good actors, to get a lot of mileage out of this idea that this guy's about to take a bath and no one's there to help him take off the chainmail. But instead, it was just a bunch of goofy, clumsy, quick cuts of things that I was thinking, wait a minute, he could obviously undo that clasp himself. You know, you're not,
and you don't see her doing it. Like, it's shown from his point of view. Like, she's doing it behind him.
It's a classic problem in that it's also cut poorly. It's acted poorly. Yeah. It's directed poorly. It's edited poorly. But on the page, there could have been something cool there. And it further progresses into this scene where the woman has to describe this man to a blind man. The blind man is asking, is he handsome? What does he look like? That sort of scene, that's an awesome concept on paper. With a director who appreciates it, and actors who appreciate it, and I think Max von Sydow's the only one who really knew what that could have been. That could have been an awesome scene, with the sexual tension between those two characters, where the woman has to describe him. Instead, Cate Blanchett just does a throwaway joke about, you know, he's got a yeoman's handsomeness when he's sober. But, oh my God, this whole idea of not knowing what color his eyes is, I loved that on paper. That could have been so... I mean, that right there, that was just, I hurt for what was lost in that scene. I mean, it was lost in a crappy movie, but that just could have been this cool standout moment that I really regretted we didn't get.
You're really right about that, because for me, the moment where Max von Sydow, playing somebody named Walter, by the way, shows up, and his first scene with Russell Crowe, where Russell Crowe's, you know, telling him what happened and handing him his sword, and he puts his hands on Russell Crowe's face, I got the feeling like this movie wants to spark.
Yep.
Like Max von Sydow is about to spark this movie. Like, he's trying to light a match here, but the match is just limp and wet, and nothing's happening. There was a scene right before
that. It's unfortunate.
Where Marion's washing her feet, and you get a sense, well, okay, something might be happening, the wheels might be turning, and then Max von Sydow comes in, and he touches Russell Crowe's face, and okay, yes, now we're almost there. And then you're right, Tom, you get to the chainmail scene, and, well, I kind of felt like, ooh, there's the kernel of a good scene here. You're in real trouble if all I'm thinking about is, well, gee, did his dudes put the armor on?
Do they undress each other?
Yeah.
Instead of thinking about sort of the tension, and there was never any sexual tension, so that we get later in the film, and he says, "I love you, Marion."
Oh my God!
Thinking, why?
That's what I was like. I don't believe you. She should say, "Really?"
I mean, there's this moment when MI5 guy kisses her as the cartoon of Nottingham. He forces her to kiss him when he's on his horse, and she touches her lips, and I'm thinking, what is going on here? Is she hot for something? She's got to be up for something. She touched her lips. Then nothing.
Yeah. Oh, there's another joke, by the way. I'm French. On my mother's side, the sheriff of Nottingham trying to fence.
That's his only line.
Yeah. All right, Kelly Wan, do you have anything for us that could have been cool that you think was squandered in this movie?
Besides Max von Sydow being good?
Yeah, that's kind of sad, isn't it?
During the Get Him to the Greek preview, I wrote, Jonah Hill's really let himself go. Is that what you meant?
They're flying over England at one point, and there's that gigantic stone mural of a horse on a hillside. My brother leaned over to me and said, is that an advertisement?
Wondering, I thought it was like some high school football team's mascot or something. It's like, what? Who did that?
Oh, yeah.
What is that doing up there?
It's an alien landing.
Aha. Uh-huh. The Beacon.
Nerd alert.
Let's talk about Russell Crowe. How did you guys feel? I've already said I thought he was like dull and brooding, didn't add anything. How did you guys feel? Are you Russell Crowe fans? How did you feel he did in this movie? Kelly Wand, what did you think of Russell Crowe?
I'm a Gladiator apologist, but he's doing the exact same shtick he did in Gladiator, so now I hate Gladiator.
Ah.
But Gladiator's okay. I mean, and he's playing a brooding dude, and that's just part of his character, and he has reason to brood. But in this, he shouldn't be so sad.
Oh, in Gladiator, he has reason to brood. Right, right. In this, his brooding just seems like, why? Who?
He's supposed to be falling in love and finding his purpose in life. And he's also trying to make a buck, which he does. I don't know. It seemed sad, which is unfortunate because the Disney Robin Hood was my favorite Disney cartoon when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
So I go into this going, oh, yeah, green. Something green and arrows. And it's blue.
And brooding.
And brooding. And
desolate. And brown. Right. Nottingham is so brown and desolate looking. He's so sullen. And, I mean, I understand we're supposed to think there's this revisionism of how he's lost his humanity and he's become godless through the Crusades and killing all those Muslims. And when he gives that speech about how they've all lost God, but he just carries that. That's the only thing he can carry through the entire film. And it just weighs it down. It just feels like it's going to sink. And he's got this constantly slightly morphing accent. I just was just aware of how no man would ever want to follow him.
That's exactly a huge problem for me too, Dingus. Is he didn't seem the least bit charismatic. He did not seem like a leader at all. I felt the same way as why are these dudes following him? And when he comes up to give the speech at the end, which by the way I had to write down his rallying cry: "Liberty by law." That is unsexiest rallying cry ever. I mean, that's his answer to freedom. From Braveheart.
Liberty by law.
But at least it's an alliteration, so it's got that going. It'd make a good
bummer. But Gladiator, he was convincing as a leader, I thought.
Like, and there was none of that here. I didn't like Gladiator, so I can't go with you there. But there was no sign of that here. There's no sign of leadership or charisma. And he killed, I mean, next to the Helgoland script, it killed the movie for me. And here's what I think the movie, and Ridley Scott specifically, was just leaning so heavily on Russell Crowe's celebrity. And it wasn't there for me. It just didn't, the material wasn't good enough, and there was no sense of his charisma there. And if I did not know Russell Crowe as a celebrity, I would watch this movie, and I would think, why did they cast this schlub in this part? You know, this guy does not fit. He does not belong. The guy playing Kevin Durant, the guy playing Little John, he seemed like more charismatic and leaderly than Russell Crowe, I thought.
Yeah. And he was a better fighter from what we saw, because Russell Crowe misses that shot.
That's right. He only gave Mark Strong a cold sore.
Yeah.
Arrow.
Gotcha. By the way, Gladiator was rated R, so maybe that's why I liked it, because there were, I don't know. You need that. If you're going to go medieval, you got to go R, dude.
I think the movie that this really calls to mind for me instead of Gladiator is Braveheart. And I don't think you liked Braveheart either, but I'm a Braveheart apologist. And whatever you have to say about Braveheart, at least you have a leader in it who people you can believe people following and has charisma and is passionate. And you also have battles that are comprehensible. After all those silly title cards, it was just days of reading. I still didn't know what that first castle siege was about.
Yeah.
And then in addition to that, you have speeches that are rousing, like Henry V speeches, and they're built to be rousing, and you have music that supports them so that they instruct us how to be roused. That speech you're referencing, Tom, was the worst rah-rah rousing pre-battle cry speech I've ever seen. It was like, I just want to say Walter sent me to tell you we build houses from the ground up, and tyranny's bad.
I just broke the foundation. Yeah.
Just horrible. It was a horrible scene, and I never understood what the king was doing there. Why is the king there? Why do we have to deal with all these politics? It's just all these weird, like, moments. The king saying, all right, he shows up to talk to William Hurt, and then they have a little argument, and he says, well, I'm going to fight those guys. And then the king just sort of shows up. at their big where they were like, we're going to fight the king, and the king shows up, I'm here, and they argue with him.
So well, that didn't do anything either.
That gets me to something, Dingus, that I want to bring up. This might sound a little highfalutin, so I just want to touch on this, and we can move on if you guys want. But I think a big problem with this movie is its politics, and it sets it apart from its source material. The source material of Robin Hood is this whole idea of stealing from the rich and giving to the poor, which these days is considered redistribution of wealth. Nobody wants that. Robin Hood is arguably a communist. You know, Bill O'Reilly would not support Robin Hood. But that's this idea of social justice. That's the underpinning for Robin Hood. You know, this turning over of the social order, stealing from the rich, giving to the poor, from Robin Hood is what he should do. And it's what he never does in this movie, by the way. What he does in this movie is take back the taxes that he was supposed to pay. In this movie, he is simply a tax evader. He does not give to the poor. It's just the burden of taxes is what he's fighting. You know, people like Bill O'Reilly, the right wing, would love the politics of this movie. Is don't give money to the government. It's inefficient. Keep your own taxes. And further,
why would they make it for them, though?
And furthermore, what I don't know that this really is the politics behind it or that this was intentional, but this is what comes out of it, of watching it, is there's none of this idea of social justice that I think drives the original Robin Hood myth, stealing from the rich, giving to the poor. Instead, there's this idea that government is oppressive, that big government is bad. It's a fundamental Republican idea. You know, lower taxes. Taxes are a burden. You know, traditionally speaking, the Democrats see taxes as a way to create social programs, to further the social good. The Republicans see it as repression. This caters to this Republican idea that taxes are oppressive, that taxes are inherently evil. Now, it sets up an excuse for it. It's to pay for this war. So I don't know. You can make an argument.
I got that sense too.
Yeah, and so furthermore, where it goes with this is it also goes to this Sarah Palin type populist crap with this like liberty by law thing, this idea of the grassroots knowing what's best. You know, the whole reveal here is that Robin Hood's father wrote the Magna Carta. I don't know, people listening, the Magna Carta was a historical document that was forced on King John, who was in the movie, and it was a first instance of constitutional law, namely this idea that the highest authority rests in a document and not in a king or a figure, that the authority is a contract. So the Magna Carta was an actual document, and what it's almost like a joke. I mean, this is literally this idea that Robin Hood's dad was a mason. You know, a bricklayer, basically a ditch digger, Joe the plumber, that he wrote the Magna Carta, and he's the one who had it forced onto King John, who did historically, by the way, try to back out of it. But this fact that a ditch digger basically wrote the Magna Carta, shopped it around to barons who signed it, and then forced it on King John through his son delivering this populist, you know, liberty by law speech, it was just so – the politics of this were just so chintzy. And if you do examine them, they're oddly Republican. They're oddly just right-wing populist crap, I thought. So there's my rant.
just FYI, the Scarlet Pimpernel saved the rich from the poor, just like Bush and Obama.
Good. Well, there you go.
I definitely got that same sense, Tom. Although I thought of it more of like as the all the teabagger or Tea Party protests on Tax Day, that whole tax and burn sequence, and which was a really horrible montage. I really started to get that feeling. And did you realize that this script was originally called Nottingham?
I'm so bummed about that too. Talk about a missed opportunity. Why don't you tell us what that was supposed to be, Dingus?
It was supposed to be about the Sheriff of Nottingham.
Yep.
And then Ridley Scott came in and said, I guess that's not dramatic enough. And then they started to try to just change the character over to make him more dramatic and action-oriented. And then they just scrapped that all together. And eventually that sheriff character becomes a minor buffoon. And it becomes an origin story for Robin of the Hood. Mm-hmm. I sort of thought about that. I was wondering, is it sort of trying to tap into this ridiculous populist anger of people who don't really understand how government works or why government works or what it does for them that they're protesting, and as I was watching, I definitely got this sort of Tea Party vibe going on, and I have no idea if that's what was going on or if they were just tapping into people paying taxes, and that's a really big thing in the country right now. Let's go for it.
Right. Right.
After this thesis, and I thought of it too when I was seeing it, I think Tom's on to something, but I can't believe, based on how boring the movie is, that they put as much thought into it as Tom's suggesting.
Well, I really do think that, I mean, why Kelly Wand? Robin Hood is a story about social justice, and social justice even has been painted as communism lately. I think that's a whole Bill O'Reilly, or not Bill O'Reilly, who's that other goofball?
Glenn Beck.
Right. Glenn Beck has this whole idea that social justice is communism, and social justice is, I think, the cornerstone of the Robin Hood story. Wouldn't you say, Kelly Wand?
Yeah, but I don't think anyone really believes what Glenn Beck's saying.
But why isn't that in this story? I don't know the answer to that.
I think they're dumb. I don't think they were trying to tease.
Okay, that may be, but its absence is, to me, conspicuous. You take this classical myth, and the point of the myth is social justice. You want to call it redistribution of wealth, social justice, communism, whatever. That's a cornerstone of what Robin Hood is. And for whatever reason, for stupidity, for political expediency, for whatever reason, it was basically surgically removed from this story and reworked into something about how taxes are evil and the common man needs to dictate law to the government rather than the other way around.
Using bees.
So we can move on from that.
One last point. I think that that's part of a trend, though, in movies lately is like, oh, we're going to do everything. We're going to make a serious historical King Arthur movie with Clive Owen, and then we're going to put a bunch of CG ice in it and all kinds of crazy shit. So they just did that here. It's like they tried to make something that wasn't historical sound historical, and they just latched onto the Magna Carta.
Right.
Speeches just wrote themselves. It was like a random speech generator.
In the sequel, by the way, I don't know if you guys know this, there's a sequel in the works, and we're going to find out that Robin Hood's grandmother weaved the Bayeux Tapestry.
Alice in Wonderland's father-in-law wrote the Magna Carta, I thought. Alice in Wonderland.
He opened China.
China, right.
Tom, you really actually, you mentioned something very early in this podcast. You really missed something. By not watching the credit sequence, by the way. Were you serious when you said you didn't watch that?
No, I skedaddled out of there as soon as the credits started rolling. What did I miss?
Well, as I watched it, I thought that it did look like the work of the guys whoever does the Scott Free logo. Is it the same?
I'm assuming. I mean, I can't imagine why not. They were certainly imitating that Scott Free logo, weren't they?
Right.
Well, did you guys see the thing at the end with Sam Jackson recruiting for the Avengers?
I missed that. But just as I watched it, it's that animated stuff there is so much more dramatic and interesting than anything in the movie. And it's basically the story of the movie just told in animation over the credits. Wow. It was quite thrilling to watch, other than one shot that looks like a shot of the Burger King. It's really pretty exciting. And I just sat there thinking, if you're going to bother doing an origin story, or if you're really hung up on doing a Robin Hood origin story, then do something bold like this. You know, do this for the first 10 minutes or 5 minutes, or, you know, make this the origin in this animated, dramatic, bloody sort of, not impressionistic, but symbolic ways of getting the story across, and then launch into the story from there. Because I think this film really needed somebody who was going to be a little odd and edgy and dark, and not just trying to do Braveheart light. You know, somebody like I forget who even who directed Kick-Ass. Matthew Vaughn, is that his name?
Matthew Vaughn from Layer Cake. Yep.
Matthew Vaughn, or even, you know, God help me, Frank Miller, to do something interesting and odd with the Robin Hood story after an extended animated prologue. Because that animation, while not perfect, was just so dramatic and interesting after just slogging through this movie that was constantly subverting its own drama.
Which is exactly, Dingus, what I would hope Nottingham would have been. You know, a story from the perspective of the Sheriff of Nottingham dealing with this outlaw. I would have much rather seen that. So,
did either of you have a favorite image? Because I had one favorite image in this movie that made me very, very happy.
I don't know about a single image, but I did enjoy like the the stealing the sailing ship, going up the Thames. Like, I liked some of that. The early, just the sort of the idea of a siege is just a day on the job. You know, that early stuff where, okay, the archers come up and then the dudes roll up the thing, the battering ram. And but as far as an image, no, you know, and that's the funny thing is Ridley Scott, traditionally, that's, you know, he's good at, like, strong images, but nothing leaps out. Oh, here you go, Dingus. Ellen of Aquitaine with her owl. I was hoping she would say to William Marshall, "Do you like our owl?" So that would be mine. What was your favorite image, Dingus?
I like that one that you mentioned of the boats going up the Thames. I thought that was the one beautiful shot, mm-hmm. where you see the high shot of the of where they're about to land. But my favorite image in the movie, unfortunately, it made me giggle, was in the battle charge in the final battle. Russell Crowe is just riding, hell-bent for leather, and he's got a hammer.
Like he's going to go build a house. He's going to build the hell out of this house and nail these nails.
All I could see was that in the hands of, like, the Zuckers or David or Mel Brooks behind him. Somebody's got a level, and another dude's got a router, and somebody's got a table saw. They're balancing on their horse.
Kelly Wan, do you have a... Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
This is like, really? He's got a hammer? Come on.
Kelly Wan, do you have a favorite image?
Well, Braveheart had a giant hammer, and he would beat people with it, which is why that movie's good. But getting back to this movie, I liked people getting shot in the throat a lot, which seemed to happen a lot. Mm-hmm. And I also liked the grain planting music montage video, where they all plant grain at night. And they're all smiling, like, this is the greatest. I love farming. God, it's so good. Using stolen grain, so much better. Grain stolen is twice as good as grain earned.
If they had been playing Enya during that, that would have been awesome. At the that moment, you getting shot in the neck. I love that Robin Hood takes the moment to do the long arrow shot on Mark Strong. And then after that, he decides to save the drowning Marion.
Yeah.
That last fight in the surf was, I think, the clumsiest surfside denouement since Keanu Reeves and Patrick Swayze in Point Break. That's all I can think.
Kings of New York.
Oh, God. And, yeah, like, he's going to get crushed by the boats. No, he's not. He's fine. And here come the Ewok kids. And just Marion, made Marion showing up at the battle. God, it was so inane. I couldn't believe that.
Was Kingdom of Heaven good? Because I remember it being good, except that Orlando Bloom kind of ruined it.
I want to see it. I have not seen it, but I'm still curious to, just because I don't know. I don't know if it was good. Dingus, can you elaborate on this for us?
Well, supposedly there's a Ridley Scott cut of it that's 3-4 hours long that is quite good. And the excuse is that the studio cut is what ruined it, which might very well be the excuse you see burbling up for this, that there was so much cut out of it that it becomes incomprehensible. And I can't imagine more of this.
Yeah. Yeah. The story beats were there, and they're really slow and arbitrary.
So yeah, the timing of this movie was horrible.
Yeah, yeah. Before we move on, I want to bring up a couple of stupid things. You guys ready? Do you have a couple of these that we can throw in?
Sure.
A stupid thing. Here's a stupid thing. So, you know, the little refrain throughout while he's struggling with his hidden origins himself is, you know, he sees the words, rise and rise again till lambs become lions, which is, you know, that would look good on a bumper sticker, like Liberty by Law or something. That's good. It's the sort of thing you'd carve in stone. That works. So he discovers the secret place where it's written, and then Will Scarlet says, "What does it mean?" When it's pretty evident, hello, I don't think you need it explained, but Robin Hood feels the need to distill it to the level of a Bushism by saying it means never give up.
Like, yeah.
How could you have missed that? Why is that dialogue in there?
I don't see how it means that either.
It does mean that.
Lions equals don't give up.
Rise and rise again. That's the very first part. Rise and rise again until lambs become...
Well,
it means never give up. I mean, duh. That's...
Oh.
Bill Scarlet, are you illiterate?
So, rise and rise again until something that can't, like, until hell freezes over. It could be any phrase.
Never
lions and lambs have nothing to do with the actual meaning of those.
Just never.
Until Burnham Wood comes to Dunsinane.
Nice.
I like that his handprints were the same size as they were when he was a baby. Or did
that's
I miss it?
No, that was his dad's hand. Yeah, he becomes his father, Kelly Wand.
Well, they close have the exact same size hand. And that's
close your eyes, Kelly Wand.
Close your eyes. That's awesome.
Close your eyes. I'm going to beam a flashback into your head.
I was going to open a secret panel when he did that.
By the way, I will bet that Brian Helgeland was so proud of this stuff in the script about hands because there's this point where Mark Strong takes the bloody oyster from the King of France after the King of France has cut his hand, his palm. And then similarly, there's the moment where Robin scratches his hand on the dying man's sword where the little wire is coming loose, and he unwraps it. So I imagine that was supposed to be like this cool moment of symmetry. You know, the two men cut their hands, and the blood leads to a discovery and a betrayal. And it was just like, oh, wow, look what you just did. Very nice, Brian Helgeland.
I thought it was a menstruation.
Mark Strong also looks a little like Joker in that one scene.
He's got the half Joker thing going.
Yeah.
Just the one half scar.
That's more deliberate than the politics. Like, oh, make it look like a Joker villain.
All right, what's something else stupid?
I thought the king was enduringly stupid.
His wife was hot.
His
new wife, right?
Where did the French? Where did the first wife go?
She was off screen the whole time. She was out.
He said a line about, I'll sign the Magna Carta on my mother's wife, but the mother's still alive at the end.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
Didn't she need to die for that scene? Okay, never mind.
Man, there's this great moment where they're about to go to war, and the king's riding his horse around, and he goes, this is my first time at war. And the woman behind me for her final comment said, what an idiot.
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between, counting 1, 2, 3, beat up on that free, getting down with 3 feet, everybody loves old.
Let's do a 3x3. How you guys feel about that?
I feel pretty good about it.
Because no one's going to see the movie, anyway.
Apparently not. Didn't beat Iron Man 2, haha. Kelly Wand
didn't?
No, it made like $37 million, I think. Iron Man 2 did another $54 million. Yeah, so.
They'll have learned nothing from that lesson. They'll go, well, we spent too much time on the script. That's why.
Yeah.
We need more robots in our. Right.
What do you got for us, Kelly Wand, for this week's 3x3?
This one's kind of weak, I think. But I have a really good topic for 3 weeks from now. Good. So just skip to that one. But for this week, instead of the good one that I could have done if I thought of it in time, is three movies that suddenly made you like an actor or director that you used to hate, which is pretty subjective and kind of boring, and I predict won't lead to much activity.
Kelly Wand, you do a terrible job of selling your 3x3s. You're too self-deprecating. I want you to
I like the one. I have a good one coming up.
Okay.
I'm selling that one at this one's expense.
So Dingus likes to lower expectations.
Ah, I see what you're doing, Kelly Wand. It's a strategic play. Very good. Dingus, since you will be announcing our 3x3 for next week later on, you go first, which I'm kind of bummed about because I think, Dingus, you and I are going to probably have the same number one. I know at least one of yours, and you're going to get it in before me, I bet. So why don't you start us out, Dingus? What's your number three actor or director?
They're all stupid. Spoiler alert.
Mine are all actors, and I would be surprised if we didn't share two, if not just one of them.
You might take my second as well as my first.
I didn't really try to be crazy or interesting about this. I just went for it. And I had a harder time actually thinking of directors. But actors were easy for me. So the first one, my number three, this is the quote that I will give to you right now. I know my son was a jerk, but I miss him.
Robin Hood?
At close range?
Robin Hood. No, I don't think either of you have seen this movie. It's a 2009 film called World's Greatest Dad.
Hmm.
Is that with the Rock?
No.
The Rock is in it, and he wears like little wings, right?
Yes, the world's greatest tooth fairy dad.
What is that?
World's Greatest Dad is a movie directed by Bobcat Goldthwait, and it stars Robin Williams.
Oh.
And Robin Williams is almost always the good housekeeping seal of don't see this movie for me. When I see his name pop up, or if I happen to actually be watching a trailer for something like Night at the Museum, and all of a sudden his face is there, I'm like, oh, forget it. Because in my view, it just feels like when he shows up, he does his level best to ruin the movie. He just can't be controlled. He has no sense of control, especially when he gets manic. And it's just, I can't stand it. When I see his name on something, it's an immediate turnoff. But he is great in this movie, and it's an odd, dark little movie. It doesn't get as dark. It isn't as dark as it should be, but it's pretty dark, and he does a great job. And it's World's Greatest Dad, and it made me like him for a little bit.
You know, okay,
like Insomnia.
Well, that's what I wanted to say, Kelly. One is I like this topic now because that exactly brings up for me things like Insomnia, where I think Robin Williams has played against that manic tendency, and this idea that he's really capping it down and trying to hold it in makes for a fascinating performance. And I can think of two other examples besides Insomnia, by the way.
I got one.
I steered away from Insomnia because of my Robin Williams problem, because I liked the original so much.
Right.
But after seeing World's Greatest Dad, it made me look back at this and that one-hour photo thing and think, do I want to see those movies?
There's, I think, the best example of it, and I forget who directed. Is it Michael Winterbottom? No, I don't know who directed this. There's an adaptation of a Joseph Conrad novel called The Secret Agent, and Robin Williams is great in that as an anarchist. And it's like in, is it 1 hour photo, 24 hour photo? What's that thing called?
I don't remember.
1 hour.
I thought it was.
It's only 1 hour.
1 hour photo is another similar one. There's one where he plays a guy who doesn't he engineer people's memories. What the heck was that called?
Yeah,
I didn't care for that one as much, but he was doing the same thing. When he settles down, and especially when he is playing someone crazy who's on the brink, literally, of exploding, which is what he is in The Secret Agent, I find him fascinating. So that's a good one, Dingus.
My favorite Robin Williams
hmm?
Is a little movie called The Survivors with Walter Matthau. Did you ever see that one?
I know of
it.
I don't know.
Dead Silence. I'm really sad that there's Dead Silence when I say The Survivors. I'm really sad now.
I don't think I've seen it. I know of it. I'm thinking of like the...
It's a really early one, and Jerry Reed's in it as a hitman. I love that movie so much.
I just get nervous at the idea of what Walter Matthau and Robin Williams could bring out in each other.
Oh, please see this movie. We have to do it with three... We have to do a whole topic on The Survivors.
It's not a wacky comedy, Kelly Wand?
It's really wacky. It's super wacky. His parrot fires him, and he gets on the phone with Jerry Reed because he...
But don't tell us that. I mean, don't give things away, because now I'm...
All right. There's a really good F-bomb in it. There's a lot of them, actually. Oh, I love that movie.
Who directed it? You know?
No Googling.
Oh, well, okay.
I Googled it earlier.
All right. That's
He made Fletch, and he made The Golden Child. And he made The Island, which I am a huge apologist for, the awesome Michael Caine Island.
From Peter, the Peter Benchley novel, The Island?
Yeah. Mm.
Michael Ritchie directed The Island?
I know.
But that's super R-rated, isn't it?
It's super awesome rated. Do you remember the Kung Fu guy?
I don't think I've seen it.
Takes on the pirates with Kung Fu. Oh, my God, I love that movie. Oh.
By the way, I just want to say, you mentioned Michael Caine. I thought of, this is sort of cheating, one of the most awesome movie lines ever. Is a Michael Caine line. It should be famous. I'm going back to the previous 3x3. It's Michael Caine in Get Carter, where he's talking to another thug, and he says, "You're a big man, but you're out of shape. For me, it's a way of life." I'm like, that, I was thinking of that today because I was in line for the movie, and there's a big guy in front of me, and he turned around and gave me a weird look, and it turns out he wasn't even looking at me, but I was thinking, what if I had to fight this guy? What would I say? And I was thinking, oh, that Michael Caine line, "You're a big man, but you're out of shape. For me, it's a way of life," and then I would kick his ass, but... He wasn't even looking at me, so I felt stupid.
That's a great movie, by the way.
Get Carter is a fantastic movie. And you know what, Kelly Wand? I am going to Netflix The Island. I'm making a note right here.
Oh, The Island. Mm. Okay.
Anyway, that conversation would go, you're a big man.
because I hit him before I even finished the line, because I kicked out early. All right, good, good. I like that. All right.
Yay. See how fun this is? What
this
a great...
This is good, Kelly.
Survivors.
Right, I'm going to drag us down now. My number three is one that Dingus doesn't have, although Dingus and I have talked about this many times. I cannot stand Danny Houston. Good Lord, that guy drives me crazy. He gets miscast in some things. Like, he's John Huston's son, for starters. And I don't think there's any inkling. When I see a Danny Houston performance, I don't get any inkling of John Huston's genius. So I get the sense that he's his son. He's like the idiot son or something of English royalty. And I've seen him in a couple of movies where he's just so poorly cast. There's a John Sayles movie called Silver City, which plays kind of like a noir detective, and he's supposed to be the sort of Philip Marlowe of this mystery, and he's not. Like, he's really hot and sexy, and he seduces Daryl Hannah, and it just doesn't work. It just felt like icky and weird. There's a weird little indie movie called Kreutzer Sonata about a guy who becomes obsessively jealous of his wife. It's like an Othello kind of thing, or like a 44-inch chest almost. But Danny Houston is the lead, and he's terrible in it, and it's awful, and there's no chemistry with the actress, and when it comes to its dark conclusion, I'm just like, really? Really? You're going to put Danny Houston in this movie? So I can't stand the guy. He was in Birth. So Birth with Nicole Kidman and Cameron Bright was the first movie where I was okay with Danny Houston because he's supposed to be unlikable, and he is. He's immensely unlikable. I can't stand the guy. But then I saw a movie called The Proposition, which is a funky Australian Western with a fantastic cast. And the fact that Danny Houston, in this fantastic cast, plays a sort of a Colonel Kurtz character in the 19th century Australian sort of a Western. He's this guy who goes out among the Aboriginals and goes a little crazy. And you get the sense that, oh, yeah, there's this, like, charismatic insanity. You know, that is the part of his father. You know, that's the offspring of John Huston, playing this character who has wandered out and gone mad among the Aboriginals in Australia. So Danny Houston, once he did The Proposition, I was like, oh, yeah, I like this guy. But then I'm back to hating him. And of course, he was King Richard in Robin Hood, a terrible Richard.
You're allowed to hate him after, just
yes.
To qualify.
That's a great one. That's great. I thought you were heading toward 30 Days of Night for a minute there.
Well, you know, I liked him in 30 Days of Night because as I was watching 30 Days of Night, I had no idea that was Danny Houston. They put so much, like, freaky vampire makeup on him. I was like, oh, they got some freakishly Romanian-looking dude to play the lead vampire. Look at him. He's awesome. And then the credits were all done, like, holy cats, I just looked at Danny Houston for 90 minutes and liked him. All right, so there's my number three. Kelly Wand, now your turn.
I picked you go Casey Affleck before this is over.
No, but anyway. Is that what you pick?
No.
Okay.
I just think you will, because I know you. I can smell your fear. My number three is from a little movie called Zapped. Speaking, of course, of Willie Ames. Just kidding.
I'm not writing it down, for Pete's sake.
I like all his work, so he can't be that, because he brought us Phoebe Cates, Naked in Paradise. So my real number three...
You have to wait for Kelly Wan's faint, Tom.
I do. I should learn by now, yeah.
I'll do a line. What are you, 12?
You just kissed me.
Yeah. I'm speaking, of course, of Julia Roberts in the great movie Closer, who I thought couldn't do lines that funny and awesome, and then she plays a total bitch in that movie, and it was great. So, Julia Roberts, Closer, number three. Thank you. That's my worst one.
Did you see, because I think Steven Soderbergh does a great job often working with actors and non-actors, and I really liked her in Erin Brockovich. So that didn't work for you, Kelly Wand?
It's okay. I forgot about that. But that was after, wasn't it? Then I liked her forever.
You're back to liking her. So you enjoyed her monstrous appearance in Duplicity.
I didn't see that one.
Okay, it's scary. I should warn you.
I thought that was Aniston.
Aniston was with Clive Owen in another movie called Derailed, which is astounding for their lack of chemistry. It's a train wreck. It is an amazing train wreck of a movie to see the lack of chemistry between Jennifer Aniston and Clive Owen in Derailed.
Yeah. She's not good chemistry with anybody, though, is she?
She that good girl thing, I thought she was okay with, was it?
That's true.
Who the love, was it Jake Gyllenhaal? I thought she had some really good scenes with Jake Gyllenhaal in The Good Girl. I think that's what it was.
You're right.
But, yeah, she's, it made me, her lack of chemistry with Clive Owen in Derailed made me want to see that thing with Gerard Butler, where it's called The
Bounty Hunt.
Yes, exactly. Just because I find it fascinating. Like, her lack of chemistry with Vince Vaughn in The Breakup, for instance.
Yeah.
Also,
Gerard Butler never has chemistry either. So it's like two chemistry-free actors working together. So that's got to be interesting.
Wait a minute. Are you right? No, come on. Gerard Butler and all the dudes in the Guy Ritchie thing, Rock and Rolla. Gerard Butler had a lot of chemistry with men in that movie. So
he's got good chemistry with his son in How to Train Your Dragon.
There you go.
That doesn't count.
Dingus, where do you fall on the Julia Roberts issue?
I was shocked at how bad she looked in Duplicity. I don't know how you make her look bad. And
she looked like her brother, didn't she?
Oh, that's not, dude, that's not right. Well, I really loved Erin Brockovich.
The woman, or the movie?
The movie. I loved the movie. And I thought she was good in it.
Another good Robin Williams is Best of Times with Kurt Russell. Football one? Okay. That's my number three, Kurt Russell.
I've already got you down for Julia Roberts. Sorry.
I know. Just kidding.
All right, good. So Julia Roberts in Closer. A little carryover from last week's list. You love that movie. Now, is it Closer or Closer?
Someone told me it was Closer and made me feel dumb, and now I think they were Ashton Kutcher.
Hey, you just stole him from my list, you jerk.
Yeah.
Oh, he's not on your list.
Well, you're going to have to wait and find out. Dingus, what is your number two? Is it Ashton Kutcher?
Narrowly edging Ashton Kutcher out is this fine film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
God's a Kid with an Ant Farm Lady. He's not planning anything.
Sounds like Billy Bob to me.
Or Escape from New York.
601, half dozen in there. Zardoz? Wait, no.
I don't think I've seen this movie.
That movie where everybody wears hats, Mulholland Drive.
Tell you what, he sounded like he was trying to do a Harrison Ford thing, just like reading Dingus's like inflection.
Yeah.
I think he thought he sounded like Harrison Ford, so I'm going to guess Mosquito. Oh, but you know what? Dingus always liked Harrison Ford, because he's a Han Solo fanboy, so it can't be.
Right, so it can't be Harrison Ford. It's got to be it's got to be someone obscure.
I think it's Ashton Kutcher and Butterfly Effect.
No.
Okay. All right, what is it, Dingus?
No, there'll be no Ashton Kutcher.
I seriously did consider Ashton Kutcher. I liked him in this wrestling movie that he did with Michelle Pfeiffer. There's a movie where he plays a wrestler and he befriends Michelle Pfeiffer, whose I think son has been murdered, and his performance he's actually good in it, and he's a little bit like Mark. Who's the guy from You Can Count on Me? Mark. I don't know, for Pete's sake.
Ruffalo.
Right, yeah, there's a little bit of, it's like Ashton Kutcher doing a Mark Ruffalo performance, and it kind of works. So I seriously almost considered Ashton Kutcher for this list, but I knew that you guys would tease me mercilessly, and I, at the last minute, thought of better ones.
You big pussy. I've never heard of that movie. It sounds kind of good.
So, Dingus, I'm sorry. So your number two, God Doesn't Play with Ant Farms Lady, blah, blah, blah. What is that from?
Blah, blah, blah. And you know Butterfly Effect isn't my number one.
Oh, sorry.
Because he didn't
sigh.
I
like that movie.
Oh, no, you did not.
Point.
No one likes it. No.
No, I
did. Stop liking
it.
Butterfly Effect.
Dingus and I both like Butterfly Effect, Kelly Wan, and you kept whining about it.
You're
did.
You're fucking with me. No,
nope.
I'm not
getting
a word of this. It's a lifelong prank on me.
You punked.
Yeah.
All right, Dingus, what is your movie? Spill the Beans. Kelly Wan and I have not seen this movie, but I bet it's good. What is it?
All right, I'm going to tell you the actor's name, and I bet you're going to be able to guess the movie.
Awesome.
The actor's name is Keanu Reeves.
Oh, dadgummit.
Okay, wait. The Gift? Or...
See, because I know what it is. But see, I've liked him before, Dingus. I don't know why you're so down on Keanu Reeves that it takes Constantine to make you appreciate him.
Ah, yeah. It's a good one. And Bill
and Ted. I didn't care for him. You know, I liked him for a moment during the first Matrix movie, because I think they got how to use him properly.
Mm-hmm.
And then he just started to just, he was just so blank, and he would tank movies. And it got to be where I would get mad, and I would sit there watching him take work from other actors who should have been getting the work, better actors, or just actors. It didn't feel like he was even an actor, and it felt like his connections were getting him jobs that, you know, that's how the business works, and that's fine, but I just still sat there stewing over the fact that this dope was getting this work. And then Constantine came along, and, you know, talk about not having any sort of history with the source material. I had none, and the movie knocked my socks off.
Yeah.
And I sat there during that movie just going, don't screw it up, don't screw it up, don't screw it up. And he carries that movie yep. and makes it work. He's, you know, he's not blank, but he's got this conversion of blankness to world weariness. And mm-hmm. and he seems much older than he is. And yet he carries forward this this spark, and there's also a bit of a sense of humor there that he never pokes fun at, he never winks at you, and I still remember after I watched Constantine, I think sending you an email, Tom, saying, or just crap, it looks like a Keanu Reeves film is going to make my list this year. I was that enamored of it.
Mm-hmm.
And
it did make your list.
Yeah, it did. And up until that point, I wouldn't say I despised him. I don't know that I could say I despised any of these guys. But I really didn't like him, didn't care for him, and I did not want to see his name on a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then when this, I went, okay, yeah, you can do this. I was really, really knocked out by Constantine.
I love that pick, Dingus, but I just don't get why you would be so hard on him, because I think he's got a very specific, up until that point, niche. And I never had a problem with him, for instance, in like Speed or Bill and Ted. I thought Speed he was legitimately good in River's Edge, for instance. It's easy to forget that. But in River's Edge, that cashed in arguably better than any other movie on his sort of blankness. Certainly The Matrix. And, you know, the Sam Raimi movie, The Gift, he was a very different kind of character in that.
Yeah.
I don't, why have you been so hard on poor Keanu Reeves? You're so mean.
I know.
I like Little Buddha. And I'm a feeling Minnesota apologist. There, I said it.
Oh, and what's the thing with River Phoenix about Iowa? Our own
private Idaho.
Yeah, exactly right. Like as a Pretty Boy in a Gus Van Sant movie, I think he works.
Yeah.
So why are you so hard on Keanu Reeves, Dingus? Did your wife date Keanu Reeves before you met? Answer truly.
What did you say? Yes, she did. And after. I'm not going to
answer. That's the
answer. All right.
All right, Dingus, who do you despise more? Just curious. Keanu Reeves or Dane Cook?
I'm not a despiser of Dane Cook.
Oh, all right. I've heard enough. I obviously can't talk to you about anything ever again.
Where did that come from?
I'm not going to answer that.
All right. I'm going to move to my number two because Dingus is, All right, Dingus.
That's outraged.
And that's a good pick, Dingus, but I just wouldn't have thought of that because I don't think I've ever been that hard on Keanu Reeves. I think he gets an unfair rap because he plays dumb guys and he has turned in some horrible performances. You are right there.
Dave Yurstead still is the worst thing ever made. Ever. He's so bad in it. Oh my God, I hate that movie. I want to murder it. Oh.
Did I use the words hard on and Keanu Reeves? I think I know why you're defending him now.
Busted. You were outed, Kelly Wand. All right, my number.
Tom.
Yes, sir, to me.
That was you who said hard on and Kelly.
Oh, no, I didn't. I'm going to roll the tape back and erase that. Okay.
A lot of handsome actors, I've noticed.
You guys know I'm a Paul Walker apologist. I have been one. Yeah. He didn't make my list because I've never loathed Paul Walker. I think he's always.
Right.
My number two is someone who I wouldn't say loathes, but just I don't get his appeal. I've never liked really any of his movies, even though I've given plenty of them a chance. I don't find him as funny as different people do. I never got what he was doing on Saturday Night Live. It just struck me as ridiculous. Adam Sandler's just like, what are you doing? Why are you people going to these movies? And I didn't get his appeal. I remember reading a review once that said something to the effect of, he's not so much as an actor as a guy who just rolls out of his trailer and shows up on the set when they're ready to shoot. And that's the sense I got. And so, you know, he does funny voices, and he's Opera Man, and he's Happy Gilmore, and he goes back to kindergarten, and it's all wacky, and I just never got that. But then I saw Punch Drunk Love, where he actually turned in a performance, and I thought you know, in Punch Drunk Love, whatever he was channeling, you know, this weird repressed guy act, I mean, was just used so well in that movie. And I think Punch Drunk Love is an actual crafted performance, and he's brilliant in it, and his chemistry is just so good with the people in it, and I love that movie, and part of why I love it is because I think Adam Sandler is really, really good in it. So I haven't liked a lot of his funny stuff since then. I really liked seeing that reappear a bit in Funny People, which is sort of more about his persona. But it was really Punch Drunk Love where I stopped loathing Adam Sandler. And that's my number two.
I guess I got to see that.
I don't get why you didn't like him before. What was so objectionable about him?
I don't think he's funny. I think he just sort of rolls in and mouths lines and talks really loud and yells and does his Hanukkah song. None of that really works for me. It's like none of that stuff works for me.
I'm just giving you a hard time.
Oh, you jerk. You were, I see. You're a jerk. You're fired.
You don't like Adam Sandler.
No, obviously, that's my number one. Thanks, you jerk.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Dingus is done.
That's not the one I thought you would take.
Well,
okay.
That's the one I took.
All right, well, so you explain, Dingus. What,
you
so
guys
you,
lose the game. This is the new way you lose.
The thing is, you're the same way. Like, don't people come to you and say, oh, Happy Gilmore's awesome, you got to see it. He hits Bob Barker with a golf club or whatever. Don't you get that all the time?
Yeah, and I had a pair of friends many years ago who just loved him and would have us over to their house to watch, like, Adam Sandler marathons, and I actually had to go to see Little Nicky in a theater right before.
Nice.
And that's the last film of his I saw before Punch Drunk Love, and Little Nicky is horrible.
Is that where he teaches a little kid to pee on the wall?
No, that's Big Daddy. Daddy.
Oh, God.
It starts with a big instead of little. That's a...
Little Nicky, he's one of the three sons of Satan, and they're trying to vie for who gets to be who gets to, you know, follow Satan to be, you know, Lord of Satanity. And it's horrid. But I was lucky for a long time because I have this friend, Jay, who used to live in California. And when my wife would really want to go see an Adam Sandler film, because Jay was such a big fan, I could just foist her off on him and they would go see, you know, Big Daddy or whatever together, and I wouldn't have to see it.
That's right. I forgot about that. Yeah.
And it was really a good thing. And then Punch Drunk Love came around, and I couldn't really avoid the film because it's Paul Thomas Anderson. And so I went to see it with, I think, three other people. And I just left that movie. I have never felt so good. I felt better about life after seeing that movie. And not everybody has that reaction. I think everybody else was more or less tepid about it. But I felt like I was walking 10 feet above the earth after seeing Punch Drunk Love. And his work in that, he's not doing any shtick. It's just, he's just flat out. I don't know how Paul Thomas Anderson got him to do it. Even when he's raising his voice, he's not doing that weird yelling opera man sort of like, you got to do whatever Kelly just did for him.
Kelly does it way better than you. Thing is, you were doing Yoda just now.
Well, I can't help it. I'm in a house full of sleeping people. It's just honest and supported in this. And it's a weird, weird relationship, but it totally works. Yeah. So, yeah, that was easily my number one.
Good. I distinctly remember, I don't often remember the circumstances in which I see a movie. Those tend to dissolve away with time. But I remember going to see Punch Drunk Love at like an 11 a.m. show after having pulled an all-nighter the night before. So already sort of feeling like in this weird state of mind and a little sleepy, but just being electrified by that movie and how that state of mind sort of fed into enjoying that movie. And it is kind of, we've talked about this before, Dingus, with certain movies, it was kind of like a drug. The elements of that movie coming together and how that movie makes me feel. I distinctly remember enjoying that after an all-nighter. Yeah. Kelly, wanted to give us a little Adam Sandler. Go. You're really good at it. I want to hear some more. That was Robin Williams from Miss Doubtfire.
I was thinking ahead.
Kelly, can you do your number two in the voice of Adam Sandler?
Try.
Okay, go.
All right, here's a line from the movie that's my number two. And stand by for the Sandler, because it's the punchline.
Okay.
Okay, set up. So here's the riddle. What does an 8,000-pound Mako shark... Is it Mako or Mako?
Mako.
Mako shark, with a brain the size of a flathead V8 engine and no natural predators think about? Well, I'm not really not here to find out!
Snap it to a Slim Jim!
Oh, I have a good Adam Sandler story.
Okay, we want to hear your Adam Sandler story before. Was that Deep Blue Sea?
Yeah.
That's who would you loathe?
Rennie Harlan.
Oh, Rennie Harlan. You were thinking directors. Good one. Good. I was good Why would you hate Thomas Jane? Yeah.
No, I love Thomas Jane. Rennie Harlan, all his movies sucked till then. I didn't like Cliffhanger, and I didn't like Die Hard 2, and I didn't like Ford Fairlane, and I didn't
Cutthroat
like
Island.
Cutthroat Island, piece of shit. And then Deep Blue Sea comes out, and Samuel Jackson does that speech. And,
it's such an awesome subversive moment. Yeah, there's so many. I mean, full of cool subversive stuff. I mean, Deep Blue Sea was like a very self-aware, funny, scary, well-made movie, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yes, it's so good.
And what has he followed up on Deep Blue Sea? What?
Nothing.
Yeah.
I think Long Kiss Goodnight with Gina Davis.
Yeah. Okay.
Which I'm not as partial to as I am to Deep Blue Sea. Because really, Deep Blue Sea is perfect.
it pretty much is. All the way down to, to the fact
that... Skarsgård.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Meeting
Saffron Burroughs.
And they both die. The fact that Saffron Burroughs gets killed at the end is awesome.
Yeah. The hot chick is like one of the last three.
Yeah.
And all the sharks die in the same ways and order that the Jaws sharks do. Spoiler.
That's not true. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
So wait, one gets blown up with a tank, with an air, with like an air
tank? Yeah, that's
and then the second one gets electrocuted?
Yeah.
How does Jaws 3, and in Jaws 3D, does he blow it? How does Lou Gossett Jr. kill Jaws 3D? Or no, it's Dennis Quaid. How does he kill the third Jaws?
I forget.
But that's really true, Kelly Wan, that the sharks die in the same means and order as the Jaws movies?
Yeah, even though Jaws the Revenge, I think, came out before that, and there's only three sharks, and he doesn't ram a boat into one of the sharks, which would have been awesome. Maybe it got cut. Spoiler alert.
So wait, I'm not clear then. Are you backpedaling from this, or is this really a part of the... Because if so, that's brilliant. Is that really a part of the movie, or...
No, that's true.
That is brilliant.
Apparently two of the four, so two of them.
Half of them get...
Three of them. There's
you
four
can't
of them?
Remember okay. The third one.
Well, I just forget offhand what at the end of Jaws 3D. It's slipping my mind, unfortunately, at the moment. But I should know from Deep Blue Sea. I should be able to make the linkage, but now all I can think about is the fence.
All right. Well, I'm going to – okay. We'll get back to this. We'll verify.
I'll bet you I'm right, and I'm not stupid.
Well, I will trust but verify. How's that? Kelly, one, give us if you're not going to do a better Adam Sandler impression, maybe you have an Adam Sandler story you can tell us.
Oh, okay. So Deuce Bigalow,
mm-hmm.
He was producing it, and there's the character in that movie, the cop who keeps exposing himself, played by William Forsythe. And so it wasn't getting laughs, and so Adam Sandler went, make him say, it's like a Twizzler. And so... in Adam Sandler movies, apparently at the last second, they always have to like reshoot stuff to make it funny because they just have a bunch of gobbledygook. So they only had one shot of him like doing it for that one shot. So you had to say it like it's like Twizzler, and then it got huge laughs.
Okay.
So he's obviously a genius.
I mean that's
not the story I was hoping for, Kelly. I didn't want something about comedy. I wanted a sex scandal.
Not really. Not with Adam Sandler. I'm not interested in Adam Sandler's sex scandal, I'm afraid. Thing is, we know you're number one, speaking of Adam Sandler. So that was really your number one. Because I thought you were going to steal my number one, but I realized you actually probably haven't seen enough Casey Affleck movies to steal my number one. Because I don't think, Dingus, did you see Lonesome Jim? Because I saw that at Sundance one year. So in Lonesome Jim, it's I think Steve Buscemi actually directed it. It's not a bad script. But Casey Affleck in the lead just bogs it down. He's terrible in it. It's just about this sort of slacker who's coming home, and he, I think coaches like a girls basketball team or something, and Liv Tyler falls in love with him. And it's just the whole time I'm watching the movie going, that's happening to that dude? No way. And of course he's always this annoying kid in the Ocean's 11 movies. I'm like, why is this guy? Oh, it's Ben Affleck's brother. Oh, he's in that? Really? He's terrible. And he was in that thing, which I never saw, with Matt Damon and Casey Affleck wandering in the desert, which is a Gus Van Sant movie called Jerry, which I heard was terrible. So Casey Affleck just had no appeal to me whatsoever. He's got this, like, brittly way of speaking, like he's got something in his mouth, and he's just a Weasley-looking kid, and I don't trust him, and I just, oh, God, it was just, he made my skin crawl for some weird reason, and I think it was mainly because of Lonesome Jim. So the fact that he was so perfect in Assassination of Jesse James as this younger, basically he's playing a younger brother figure, sulking in the shadow of someone else's celebrity, in the case of the movie, Jesse James. And he's so good in that role. And all the things about him that made my skin crawl, that made him seem creepy, just made him seem so poignant and sad and pathetic and sympathetic in this movie. And he's surrounded by such good actors, and he's so good with them in the different scenes. And was he nominated for supporting actor for an Academy Award?
Was he nominated for that or Gone Baby Gone?
I'm pretty sure it was Assassination. I could be wrong. But
he should have been nominated for Best Actor.
Yeah, absolutely right. But the politics of it, I understand why he wasn't. But I feel that that was indeed just a fantastic performance. As an actor, I really liked what he was doing in that movie. And since then, I think I'm now officially a Casey Affleck fan. I thought he was very good in Gone Baby Gone, which played on some of the similar strengths of him as an actor, in which basically he's a guy trying to wear adult pants, not quite ready to wear the grown-up pants yet, but he's sort of thrown in a situation where he tries to. I liked him in Gone Baby Gone as well. So that was the number one that I thought you were going to steal, Dingus. But I guess you'd never really had occasion to have Casey Affleck make your skin crawl like I had before.
Yeah, no, really not. I'm not trying to grief you for giving me grief over Keanu Reeves. But yeah, he never really hurt my feelings the way he apparently hurt yours. And I liked him in Gone Baby Gone. I loved him in Assassination of Jesse James, which became my favorite film that year. But unfortunately, I'd already made my list, and it couldn't be at the top of my list.
That's too bad.
Brilliant film, and he's so, so good in it. But before that, he doesn't register for me as anything other than sort of a bit player who's one of the four guys in the car, like in Good Will Hunting. And he's fine in Good Will Hunting. He's an anchor for the accent, basically, is what his purpose is in that movie. And so he never really made my skin crawl or made me. He never bothered me at all.
Right. Well, it's so funny, too, because early on in Assassination of Jesse James, in the very first scene, in fact, he comes up behind Sam Shepard, and Sam Shepard says something to him like, you're creeping me out, you know, go away, go back to camp. And I felt the same way. I was like, oh, you and me both, Sam. But by the time that movie was over, God, my heart went out to him. He's so good in that, and it's so perfect for him. So I am now a Casey Affleck fan. I did not used to be, and it took that movie. So there's my number one.
I saw Jerry, and it mm-hmm. goes on forever. Spoiler alert. And there's this one shot. It's like goes on for 9 hours where they're like totally out of water and exhausted and like moving, like shuffling across the desert, and then slower, and then slower, and then slower, and then slower, and then slower.
Knock, knock.
What has 18 legs and isn't going anywhere?
This movie! My number one.
All right, what do you got for us? Rock and roll.
All right, here's a catchphrase from it.
Mm-hmm.
Now what?
Is the laugh a part of the catchphrase?
No, that was my editorializing.
Is that a line that should be famous?
I think I blew my throat out with the Sandler stuff.
I don't
so
the line.
A little 1998 film made by the man who brought you The Mummy, a movie I can't stand, and all the other Mummy movies.
Mm-hmm.
Director Stephen Sommers made a little movie called Deep Rising. with Treat Williams and Famke Janssen about a giant squid.
Spoiler.
Did you see that?
No, I saw it. I saw it. That's not the one. Yeah. I confuse it with the one with Peter. Who played RoboCop?
Peter Weller.
Peter Weller. I confuse it. There's a Peter Weller deep
Leviathan.
Rise. Leviathan. Right. I confuse those. This is the one that had the comic relief from The Mummy is also in that, right?
Yeah.
They escape on a jet ski. Am I not mistaken?
Yeah, and it's chasing them.
Right. And who could you not stand beforehand? Treat Williams?
No, Stephen Sommers.
Oh, the director.
I couldn't stand him later. Maybe this is totally wrong, because I liked him, and then I didn't like him.
That's okay. I mean, that fits what you've set for the list.
But Deep Rising's good. Remember that scene where Wes Studi, am I saying his name right, is getting eaten, and so the comic relief gives him a gun so he can kill himself, because he's going to die anyway, and then he shoots at the comic relief guy, and then wastes his bullet and misses like an idiot, and then monster eats him slow. That's good. That's like a Weird Tales kind of ending, right?
I should read
Stephen Sommers.
Yeah. Okay.
Am I overselling Deep Rising? I remember thinking it was good, but maybe I'm really, really dumb.
The thing is, the tough thing, Kelly Wand, is Deep Blue Sea is a tough act to follow.
Yeah, but it's got deep in it.
It's true.
And it's about sea creatures. And all the squids in Deep Rising are killed in the same way that Phantasm Balls are killed.
There's like another ghost ship one that has the chick from E.R.
Ghost ship.
It's called Ghost Ship. Oh, it is called Ghost Ship. Okay, and who is the chick from ER? Who's the dude in that?
Gabriel
Margolis.
No, that's right. Thank you, Dingus. What's the dude's name, Kelly Wand?
Gabriel Byrne.
Oh, it is Gabriel Byrne. That's right. Again, on a tugboat. Gabriel Byrne in tugboats.
That's made by those guys that made 13 Ghosts.
Yes.
But they have these great budgets, and they build these awesome sets, like the 13 Ghosts house, and then...
Right. That's right. As far as, like, seagoing horror movies, I recommend to you guys, and everyone listening, a movie called Triangle with, Melissa George or Susan George? Dingus, who's the chick from In Treatment?
Susan George.
Yes. A movie called Triangle with Susan George. I think that trumps Deep Rising and Ghost Ship as far as, because it relies more on concept than, like, effects and whatnot. So there you go.
But it's not someone who normally sucks and is suddenly good just one time.
Right. You got me thinking of horror movies about passenger ships, which was the case with Deep Rising and Ghost Ship. Yeah.
Right. Well, there's my stupid list.
It's a good
Sorry.
List. You know what, Kelly Wand? I was down on your list until I realized, you know what, it would engender some interesting discussion. I now quite like your list, Kelly Wand. So.
Well, that was the... It sounds lame. And then it is lame.
I disagree with the second part of your... I agree with the first part of what you said. That was a quote from Seven. I don't know if y'all know that. The final line of Seven is Morgan Freeman saying, Ernest Hemingway once said, the world is a good place and worth saving. I agree with the second part. Final line in Seven. There you go.
One, two, three. Ernest Hemingway.
Let's see. So next week's 3x3... is brought to you by Dingus McClansky. Dingus McClansky, what do you have for our 3x3 next week?
All right. The 3x3 for next week, I've given you guys a couple of weeks to mull this over. So you should have been doing some homework, whether you knew it or not. Because I'm going to pull out something from the double feature list and make it a 3x3. Because that's what that list was anyway. And this coming 3x3 is a recommended by list. Specifically, three movies that you watched because they were recommended by another movie you were watching. And I'm not talking about because you were watching the movie and it made you think, boy, I wonder if this movie is like that. But there's actually something in the movie that references directly the movie I'm talking about. And okay, for our double features thing, one of the films I referenced was a film called Sweet Smell of Success, and I had no idea what that movie was before I watched the movie Diner, which is a movie I love, and a character there's a minor character in Diner that quotes Sweet Smell of Success incessantly, apparently. And that got me to watch Sweet Smell of Success and really quite fall for it. It's a movie that I return to every few years. So I've watched within the last week one movie that talks about another movie and has a character going to see that movie. And one of the movies we've done for this very podcast within the last month or two has an extended sequence from another movie. So you need to think about movies that you've seen where characters are either watching a movie or they talk about a movie, however you need to do it. So a movie that was recommended by another movie.
This makes me think, Dingus, of those little nested Russian dolls. It's like we have to have a Russian doll inside. I like this. I like this list. Kelly Wan, do you like this list?
I think it's hard.
It is going to be hard, but I already am thinking of one right now. And I'm going to enjoy thinking of a couple more. So, yeah.
It is hard, and I'm not sure it's going to give us much opportunity for discussion, but it's something that fascinates me.
I like it. I like it. Good.
I'm scared. All right.
So, yeah, we'll see what we come up with. So, for those of you listening, next week we are going to see Shrek 3D.
What?
No,
we're
not. Oh, no. I'm sorry. Next week we're going to see MacGruber, which is
really
awesome. MacGruber. Next week.
We are?
Stop.
So, yeah, for those of you listening, we just could not bring ourselves to see MacGruber or Shrek. So what we're going to do instead is talk about a movie that just is coming out on DVD. It will be out the Tuesday. It'll be out this week. The Messenger with Woody Harrelson, not the Joan of Arc thing that I think is a Luc Besson deal. The Messenger with Woody Harrelson comes out on DVD. We are going to ditch Shrek and MacGruber and instead rent The Messenger. So join us next week for The Messenger and for Dingus's 3x3, which is three movies recommended by other movies, and we'll be back then. I am Tom Chick. I am joined by Christian McCrowley. McCrowley? Did I get it right? Christian McCrowley.
Fool of a Murawski.
Ah, close, right. And Kelly Wand.
The price is wrong, bitch.
Fucked that up.